All right, let's pray together before we begin. Father, we're so thankful to once again turn to your word and tonight to the very practical issue and doctrine of our relationship to and our understanding of the Church of Jesus Christ. Bless our minds with understanding and bless this first lecture by way of helping us to lay a foundation for a proper understanding of this issue in the Scriptures. We pray for your Spirit's help and for sharp minds and soft hearts. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Now, as you can see, and as I said in my prayer, this is part six of the course. We have six lectures to do it this week and next week. Section one of part six I'm calling General Foundation, and there are two parts to it, a scriptural foundation and a creedal foundation. First, tonight we're going to look at, in this first lecture, we're going to look at the scriptural foundation for the doctrine of the church, do some brief word studies, acquaint you with the data that's very important. Second lecture is going to be creedal. We're going to talk about the Nicene Creed and the four attributes of the church that have been identified historically on the basis of the scriptures. And then the last lecture begins the whole subject of the special regulation of the church, i.e. the regulative principle. So here we go. The doctrine of the church is a massive subject, normally taught as a three-hour course. I get six lectures, and again, I'm frustrated by that, but it's the way it is. It is what it is. That's our outline. General Foundation, Lectures 1 and 2, Special Regulation, Lectures 3 and 4, Ordained Administration, Lecture 5, and the Societal Relations of the Church, Lecture 6. All right? Now, in displaying the scriptural foundations of this doctrine, there are five things to be considered. There you see them. Basic definitions, Old Testament background, New Testament uses, related terms, comprehensive summary. So basic definitions. Now, in the Bible, there are two terms, of course, one Hebrew and one Greek, in parallel to each other in the two Testaments that are preeminent in the biblical materials. And the Greek is ekklesia, normally translated church in the New Testament. And the Hebrew, kahal, translated commonly by ekklesia, although not exclusively by ekklesia in the Old Testament, the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament. Kahal, first of all. Kahal occurs as a verb, and there it means to assemble. And as a noun, it means assembly. A verb is often translated in the LXX. That LXX, for any of you that aren't familiar with it, is the 70 or the Septuagint, which is the ancient Greek version of the Old Testament, used by Christ and his disciples, and often quoted, at least loosely, in the New Testament. The noun is most frequently translated by ekklesia and its relatives, but it's also translated by synagoge, which, if that looks familiar, is the word from which we get synagogue, and its relatives. Kahal occurs 164 times in the Old Testament. That's the wonderful thing about our Bible works. It tells you those things. And the theological word book of the Old Testament defines it this way: an assembly of any sort and purpose may be designated by kahal. And that's fine, as long as it doesn't prejudice you against the idea that such assemblies were often organized and legal assemblies, and we're going to see some reasons to believe that the kahal of Israel was such a legal and organized assembly. Ekklesia. Now, in the case of the Greek word for church or assembly, only the noun occurs in the New Testament. In the Septuagint, you have some occurrences of a verb that is ekklesiazo or something like that, which means to church or to assemble. But only the noun occurs in the New Testament. And the idea of ekklesia, which if you look at the etymology of the word, ek, out of, ekklesia, from kaleo, to call, means the called out, or means called out or assembled. Now, standard lexical definitions recognize that this word has begun to take on an even more official meaning than kahal in the Old Testament. One standard lexicon remarks it is a gathering of a religious, political, or unofficial group. Another even states that it's a group of citizens assembled for socio-political purposes. You've all heard of the ancient Greek democracies, the city-states. When they assembled to vote on issues, those assemblies were called ecclesiae, okay, churches. Another definition speaks of, in a general sense, of a gathering of citizens. So ecclesia has really a twofold background. I may say this as an aside. Ecclesia points back to Kahal in the Old Testament and the Kahal of Israel, the Assembly of Israel. And ecclesia also is used of the Greek city-state assemblies where they would come together officially to vote on issues confronting those ancient democracies. So a general summary of Kahal and ecclesia in the Old Testament. Of the 162 occurrences, you said 164. Well, there are two participles, and I'll talk about those in a second. Of the 162 occurrences of Kahal in the Old Testament, approximately 96 times it is translated by ecclesia or its relatives. Twice, ecclesia translates a relative of Kahal, Machel. You can see the same QHL root in there, which is the participle. So there's the 164 occurrences. Another 45 times, synagoge, to gather, or its relatives, translates kahal. So ecclesia, 96 times, synagoge, 45 times. So there are 164 occurrences of kahal and makel, 98 times by ecclesia, 45 times by synagoge, 21 times in a variety of ways. That makes 164. Now, there are 101, and now we're going to look at the Septuagint and say, how many times does ecclesia occur? Well, it occurs 101 times. It or its relatives, 98 times out of those 101, it translates kahal. Three times, it's not a translation of kahal or makel. Okay, I mean, I know that's just kind of statistics. Some people like statistics, some people don't, but it's helpful to get a picture of how these words are used in the original languages of the Bible. Important specimens of Kahal translated by ecclesia. Here I just want to give you a few of the places where the Hebrew Kahal is translated by ecclesia in the Septuagint. Here's one of them. Deuteronomy 4:10. Remember the day you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb, when the Lord said to me, assemble the people to me, that I may let them hear my words, so they may learn to fear me all the days they live on the earth, and that they may teach their children. When Israel assembled around Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai, to hear the Ten Commandments, and to become the covenanted people of God, That was called the day of the church in the Septuagint, the day of the assembly. So Israel's assembly, that great day when they were covenanted by God and became God's old covenant people officially, is the day of the church. Okay? Interesting background. You need to hear that in the Greek to see how it informs some of the occurrences in the New Testament. Deuteronomy 9:10. The Lord gave me the two tablets of stone written by the finger of God, and on them were all the words which the Lord has spoken with you at the mountain from the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly, on the day of the church. Okay? Deuteronomy 18:16. This is according to all that you ask of the Lord your God in Horeb on the day of the church or assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God, let me not see the great fire anymore, or I will die. Now, here are important specimens of Kahal translated by ecclesia. Furthermore, and these are interesting because now we begin to see that the Kahal of Israel was an official, organized, legal, formal assembly. Deuteronomy 23:3, no Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord, none of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord. You see, there were entrance requirements. Ammonites and Moabites need not apply unless they were 10 generations removed in the promised land. Deuteronomy 23:8, The sons of the third generation, this is a different ethnicity, the sons of the third generation who are born to them may enter the assembly of the Lord. Now again, the point is not third generation, tenth generation, or what ethnicity it is. The point is there were entrance requirements. There were entrance prerequisites for to be a part of the assembly of Israel. Judges 20, verse 2 is interesting. The chiefs of all the people, even of all the tribes of Israel, took their stand in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. This, again, is translated church. Took their stand in the church of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. This is a war church. A war church. And that's very significant when we come to some of the usages of the word church in the New Testament. So also is Jonathan, Judges 21:5. Then the sons of Israel said, who is there among all the tribes of Israel who did not come up in the church to the Lord? For they had taken a great oath concerning him who did not come up to the Lord at Mizpah, saying, he shall surely be put to death. Again, this is a reference back to the same war church that you have referred to in Judges 20, verse 2. And then there are worshiping churches as well, 1 Kings 8:14. When the temple was dedicated by Solomon, then the king faced about and blessed all the church of Israel. Let's read it that way, because that's the way the disciples of Christ read it. That was the background for the way they heard the word church when Jesus used it. Then the king faced about and blessed all the church of Israel while the church of Israel was standing. That's a worshiping assembly. Interim conclusions from this study of the Old Testament, Kahal, translated by Ecclesia. Ecclesia translates Kahal at significant moments in Old Testament history, the assembly around Mount Sinai and at the dedication of the temple, and even great assemblies for war are called Ecclesiais. Actually, the Greek would be Ecclesiae, but okay. These assemblies have a formal character. They speak with one voice. They can act legally. They have entrance requirements, and they can exclude individuals from these assemblies. These assemblies have, in the Old Testament, a national character. Israel's leaders, we didn't look at any of the texts that say this more explicitly, Israel's leaders represent and speak for the whole nation. So when the clan leaders show up, they're representing their whole clans, and all those clan leaders are representing the whole nation, legally representative. Though women and children may be present in the Old Testament national Israel, they were not legally a part of the assembly, of the formal assembly. You had to be circumcised. Women weren't circumcised, okay? They might be present. They may be allowed to be present, but they were not, so to speak, full members or voting members of the church in the Old Testament. So this raises questions to us. Does this mean that the New Testament church is composed only of men and may be legally represented by its leaders? Well, here we confront the fact that there are significant differences between the Old Testament church and the New Testament church. One of those differences is the Old Testament church was an ethnic nationality. New Testament church is not. Also a different is the fact that the initiatory rite into the church, baptism, includes both men and women. The Old Testament rite, circumcision, did not. Okay? But these are the kind of questions that get raised by the use of the term church in the Old Testament. We must answer those questions, I'm going to assert here, in light of the New Testament's teaching about the transformed New Covenant Ecclesia. New Testament uses of ecclesia. Now, the noun, and only the noun, occurs in the New Testament, and occurs 114 times. There's one other occurrence in, do I have it down here? In Acts 2:47, which the noun is used, but that's a textual variant and probably not the original reading of the passage, okay? So a survey of all 114 uses of ecclesia in the New Testament is valuable, and I actually do a survey like that when I teach doctrine of the church. We look at every last one of those occurrences, because I think it's a really valuable thing to do. But we don't have time to do that tonight, and you're so grateful for that, aren't you? The first two occurrences of the word, however, we are going to look at in some detail, because they are really pivotal. I almost included a third occurrence of ecclesia, the one in Hebrews 12, 23 and 24, where the writer refers to the church of the firstborn ones, which I think is a really significant use of church as well. But really, that even that occurrence doesn't approach the occurrences we're going to look at in terms of importance and doctrinal and theological importance. And those two occurrences are both in the Gospel of Matthew, and they are the first two occurrences in the New Testament of the word church, and the only occurrences in the Gospels, by the way, Matthew 16:18 and Matthew 18:17. If I were to ask you, what's the peculiarity of the Gospel of Matthew? You know, each gospel has its own peculiarities, right? Its own particular emphases. The Gospel of Matthew is the gospel of, and for, particularly, the Jews. It's interesting that the term a church occurs in the gospel that is particularly for the Jews. This is the gospel about Jesus being the son of Abraham and the son of David, right? Anyway, here we go. Some observations. Matthew 16:18, you're familiar with it. I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not, the word is usually translated, overpower it. I'm going to question that translation later in these observations. First observation. This is the first and one of only two uses of ecclesia in the Gospels. This does not necessarily imply. There's this old tradition of the law of first occurrence. Have you ever heard of the law of first occurrence? That is to say, supposedly, the first occurrence of any word in the Bible is the most important one, pivotal one. I'm not sure that's actually true. In this case, however, this is probably one of the illustrations of it that they would use to prove it, because this is really important. This verse does suggest a number of important and foundational thoughts. It's clear from later allusions to it that this passage is foundational, because Jesus talks about the church being built on the rock, and in some sense Peter is identified as that rock, although we have to be careful what we do with that. You are Peter, a little rock, and upon this rock I will build my church. We're going to talk about what that means in a second. But the point is, this whole idea of the church being built on a foundation is alluded to three times in the New Testament, Acts 9:31, Ephesians 2:20, and Revelation 21:14. Also, all speak of the church being built on a foundation, and the last two explicitly of the church being built on the foundation of the apostles like Peter. The second observation is this. The two uses of ecclesia in the Gospels occur in Matthew, the most Jewish of the Gospels. Now, that's interesting because it alerts us to the fact that the uses of ecclesia in the Septuagint of the Old Testament to translate kahal may be very important for the way we interpret Matthew 16:18. And we're going to find out that that's actually true. Third observation, Jesus speaks of, you notice, my church. I will build my church. Now this, of course, you know, means more than simply the church of which he's a member. We talk about my church as the church of which we're a member, but Jesus means much more than that. We have to understand Jesus' reference to my church here in light of the Old Testament references to the Kahal Yahweh, the church of Yahweh, or the Kahal Elohim. Just as the Old Testament Israel church was the church of Yahweh and the church of God, this is the church of Jesus, the church of Christ. And yes, as we're going to see, there is the implication of his being Elohim and Yahweh when he talks about my church. In Matthew 18:20, Jesus implies his omnipresence when he says that wherever his church gathers, there he is in the midst of them. And the imagery is the imagery of the Old Testament. Israel gathered around Mount Sinai, the church of the Lord, the church worshiping, gathered around the special manifestation of the Lord's presence in the temple. And this is the Old Testament background when Matthew 18:20 says that the church is gathered around Jesus Christ. Thus, Jesus pictures himself in Matthew 18:20, and here, I think, as Yahweh gathering a church around himself, just as in the day of the assembly at Mount Sinai. Whatever else Jesus means, then, when he speaks of building his church, the idea that he pictures himself as the one who assembles it around himself is clear. Fourth observation, Jesus refers to building his church. Jesus refers to building his church. What does Jesus mean by this peculiar way of speaking? And it is a peculiar way of speaking. It doesn't sound peculiar to us because we're used to the idea of churches being buildings. And so it's easy to think of buildings being built. But of course, churches weren't buildings. They were assemblies. And the idea of building an assembly is frankly kind of odd when you think about it. This language is kind of, peculiar in the sense of what is its precedent in Scripture, and where is Jesus getting this idea from of building an assembly? You gather an assembly and you build a house, right? But Jesus speaks of building an assembly. Seems to be mixing his metaphors. So we have to inquire as to the specific meaning and origin of Jesus' peculiar reference to building his church. And what I did when I was trying to find out what this meant was go back and look at the term church and the word building in the Old Testament and see if I could find any places where church and the noun church and the verb build are used together in the Old Testament Septuagint. And in fact, there is one place that the two words are used together within two verses. And yet, even there's some questions about it. Yeah, that's going to come up here in a second. The Septuagint of Psalm 89, 4 and 5, uses both church and build. I will establish your seed forever and build up your throne to all generations. The heavens will praise your wonders, O Lord, your faithfulness also in the assembly, church of the holy ones. Now, so here, within the space of two verses, and I think perhaps only here in the Old Testament, church and build are used closely together. The problem is the assembly of the holy ones is probably not, I don't know, to me it seems more like a reference to angels or something, okay? But nonetheless, the whole use of build here is significant because he speaks of building up the throne of Messiah, building up the throne of the seed of David. So this passage speaks of Yahweh's determination to fulfill his covenant with David and to establish David's seed on his throne, and then to build up that throne. Now, you say, okay, but we still don't have building a church. But remember that the church, or at least the foundation stone of the church, Peter, is given what? The keys of the kingdom. And so here we do have, I think, an Old Testament statement that is maybe relevant to Matthew 16:18. And I think then we can parallel Psalm 85:4 with Isaiah 9:7. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness. From then on forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. And here we have again the increase of the Messiah's government, the establishment and upholding of his throne. So the building of the church refers, I think, in Matthew 16:18, to the increasing of Christ's kingdom. And I've already told you to think about that reference to the keys of the kingdom in Matthew 16:19. Though the assembly of the holy ones may not refer to Christ's church, this passage provides a key to the meaning of Matthew 16:18, I think. Fifth observation. Central to the passage is Peter's confession of faith. In Matthew 16:16, who do you say that I am, Peter? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then the whole passage flows out of Peter's confession. Remember that? And then Jesus says, Peter, flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. So this is something divinely revealed to Peter. And verse 18, it's the rock or foundation of the church that he intends to build. And then verse 19 says that Peter is given the kingdom keys in view of his confession. All right? So the whole thing is flowing out of this confession. The the fact that it was divinely revealed, verse 17, the fact that Peter's the rock of the church in some sense, verse 18, the fact that he's given the kingdom keys, verse 19, all of it flows out of the confession. You have to understand how key that confession is to Matthew 16. And so it's clear that it is not Peter personally who is the rock of the church, but it is, so to speak, Peter confessionally that is the foundation of their church. Why does Jesus call Peter, in some sense, the rock of the church? Not because of who he is personally, but because of his confession of faith. And that leads us to the conclusion that it's the confession of faith. And what is confessed? That is the key here. So Paul in Ephesians 2:20 and John in Revelation 21:14 and 19 allude to Matthew 16:18 and affirm that not just Peter, but the apostles are the foundation of the church or the rock of the church. So we aren't to think of Peter exclusively. We aren't to think of Peter personally. We're to think of Peter confessionally. We're to think of Peter apostolically. It's in his capacity as an apostle that he's rock of the church. And so, therefore, are the other apostles. The revelation summarized in Peter's confession is the rock of the church. Peter and the other apostles are simply its custodians, and in that capacity, the rock of the church. This is further confirmed from parallel places where Jesus Christ himself is said to be the foundation of the church. It's not just apostles who are said to be the foundation of the church. Christ is said to be the foundation of the church. Romans 15:20, 1 Corinthians 3:10-12. Well, how can it be both apostles and Christ? Well, very simply, the apostles are the foundation of their church because they confess Christ. And ultimately, it's the truth about Christ that they confess that is the foundation of the church. And so, Romans 15:20, 1 Corinthians 3:10-12. This is also clear from parallel passage in which Jesus is identified as the cornerstone of the church. The church then is gathered and built on the basis of the truth Peter confessed about the identity of Jesus Christ. Okay? So you see how central this confession is to the identity of the church. That's really important as we go along. Sixth observation. The singular reference to my church, I will build my church, provides the first hint of the doctrine of the universal church. Now, I'm going to talk about the universal church and the local church. But it's clear here in Matthew 16:18 that Jesus is talking about the universal church. Because he says, I will build my church, and the gates of hell won't prevail against it. So what? Well, so this is a church that Jesus is building throughout the world and throughout the age. It's not a single local church. It's not a particular church or society. It is a universal church. Christ has one church in this sense. And that is what is called the universal church. Now, a lot of things need to be said about what that universal church means and what it doesn't mean. A lot of falsehoods been based upon the doctrine of the universal church. Some Baptists have so reacted against the doctrine of the universal church, they don't even want to believe in it. Those people are called landmark Baptists because they deny the doctrine of the universal church. Nonetheless, here I think we have a clear, among a number of places in the New Testament, a clear reference to the universal church. Seventh observation. Clearly implied is that Christ's church is, in some sense, beginning in the days of Christ's first advent. You are Peter. On this rock I will build my church. And all of that implies that the church is beginning in Jesus' day. Now, that's a significant thing to say because, of course, covenant theology and the old confessions teach that the church includes all the elect people of God. And, in fact, I think there's basis to say that. But even if there's basis to say it, we have to appreciate that in the sense of Christ's church, in the sense of the church as it differs from the church of Israel, that and there's a sense in which the church is new and beginning in Jesus' day because it's a radically different kind of church. There are significant discontinuities between the Church of Israel and the Church of Christ. And this is one of the passages that teach the newness of the Church of Jesus Christ in the New Age. There is the Old Covenant Church, and there is the New Covenant Church. Are there connections? Of course. But are there differences? Absolutely. So we're confronted with a serious question about the relation of Christ's Church to the Church of Israel. On the one hand, believing that Jesus is Yahweh, it's difficult not to see some relationship between Christ's church and Yahweh's church in the Old Testament. On the other hand, it's apparent that in some sense, the church of the Messiah begins in the last days that his coming inaugurates. Okay? So, the church, maybe we're going to have to end up saying something like this. This is what I end up saying in the full-blown doctrine of the church class, that the church is both old and new. And I think we have to balance those two perspectives in a way that Pedo-Baptist covenant theology on the one hand and dispensationalism on the other doesn't balance them. Eighth observation. Interesting is the close relation assumed by Jesus between God's kingdom and his church. We've already noticed it, that Peter, the rock of the church, is given the keys of the kingdom. The notion of building his church is derived from the idea of building David's throne and the increasing of the government of the seed of David, of the kingdom of God. Now, that's all true, but the thing you don't want to do is to simply equate the church with the kingdom, okay? Now, you read a lot of sermons, books, where church and kingdom are simply, there's an equal sign. And that is not altogether inappropriate, because clearly even our passage is saying that there's a very close relationship between church and kingdom, right? Peter, the rock of the church, is given the keys of the kingdom. So who can deny that there's a close relationship between church and kingdom? But saying there's a close relationship between church and kingdom and saying they're the same thing, putting an equal sign there, that's two different things. The fundamental idea of God's kingdom is his sovereignty, and only secondarily a realm over which he rules. God's throne is in the heaven. His kingdom rules over all. New American Standard translates, his sovereignty rules over all. And that's a good translation, but the word in Hebrew is kingdom. His kingdom rules over all. Now, does that mean that there's a piece of real estate? This is what we think of when we think of a kingdom, right? That rules over all? No. When the Bible uses the term kingdom, we have to understand that the root idea is not realm, a piece of real estate, but reign, and the idea of a throne. Follow that? The keys of the kingdom are not so much keys to the realm as keys by which the throne rights or sovereignty of God are exercised. The keys of the kingdom are not keys that unlock the gates into the realm. They're keys that give you the authority, delegated authority of God to do certain things, okay? His sovereignty. So when the kingdom refers to the sovereignty of God and salvation creating the realm of the saved, then kingdom and church are closely related. I mean, the kingdom is the sovereignty of God. How is the church created? By the sovereignty of God, by God coming down, creating the church. And so there's a close relationship between church and kingdom, but they're not the same thing. The church is an assembly. The kingdom is God's reign, and secondarily only a realm. The kingdom is not the church, but it does create the church. Ninth observation, Christ's church is presented as conquering its enemies. Now, this is where the passage gets really interesting, because here we have a promise that has to be formative and basic for how we look at the doctrine of last things and prophecy. Christ's church is presented as conquering its enemies, and the gates of Hades will not prevail or overpower it. Not a few people, influenced perhaps by the pessimism of popular contemporary views of prophecy, have assumed that the church here in Matthew 16 is pictured in a defensive rather than an aggressive mode. The church is on the defense. And yes, true, the gates of hell won't prevail against it, but it won't overpower it, but the church is on the defensive. Hence, translations like the gates of Hades will not overpower the church are common, and they suggest to a lot of people that the church is on the defensive. Now, the fact is that this verb, often translated conquer, overpower, or prevail, actually simply means basically to make strong. And here's what's really interesting. When you go back to the Septuagint, you see that this verb is used of fortifying a defensive position, making a defensive position strong. Uzziah built towers in Jerusalem, and then he uses the word Jesus used here, and fortified them, made them strong. It doesn't make sense to translate it prevailed them or conquered them or anything like that, or overpowered them, but it's the same verb Jesus uses in Matthew 16. 2 Chronicles 32:5, and he took courage and he strengthened the millow in the city of David and made weapons and shields in great numbers. What was he doing? He was strengthening their defensive fortifications. You follow that? That's really important. The implication, then, that the church is on the defensive is undermined by the fact that even if the word verb is translated by words like defeat, overpower, or conquer, the assertion of the text is negative. The gates of Hades will not prevail, will not defeat the church. So one could understand the text to mean that the gates of Hades will not defeat the attack of the church. But a number of features actually of the passage actually suggest that it is the church that is the aggressor. Conquering against the gates of Hades. Notice, gates are defensive fortifications, right? Gates are not, you know, catapults. The gates are defensive fortifications. And the gates of Hades, translated the way the Old Testament uses the verb of defensive fortifications, and the gates of Hades will not be strong against the church. That's probably the right way to translate it. So the language naturally suggests that the church is attacking a fortified city. Hades is then on the defensive. And the expansion of the church is suggested by the earlier reference of Christ. I will build my church. Here's he's building his church. The church is on the advance. The church is the aggressor. The church is attacking. And what's it attacking? The gates of the city of Hades. And the gates of the city of Hades will not be strong against the church. Now that's what Jesus said. But I bet you that isn't the way you normally read the passage, is it? But that's what Jesus said. So the force of his statement seems to be that nothing shall hinder the expansion of his church. And here, the Old Testament background of ecclesia is helpful. Because when you look at the Old Testament, remember, that there were not just worshiping churches, there were what? There were war churches. What is Jesus' church in Matthew 16, 18? It is a war church. It is attacking the gates of Hades. And all of that brings us to the second you may have questions about that. I hope you do, actually. It's painful to me to just fly through this stuff and not be able to stop for questions right here and now. But we'll stop in a second as soon as we do a couple more things. Matthew 18:17. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Matthew 18:17 is remarkable, both in the ways that it's similar and in the ways that it's dissimilar to Matthew 16:18. Okay? First of all, we notice that here the church is an accessible entity. You can take something to the church. Now, it'd be hard to take something to the church that Jesus is building across the world and through all time. So it's likely not the universal church we're talking about here. Hard to take something to the universal church. I guess with internet, maybe you can send an email to everybody that has a religious website or something. I don't know. But the point is, that's not what Jesus is talking about. The church is accessible here, and that means it's a concrete, visible, and particular entity. And here we have then the teaching of the New Testament about local churches anticipated. If the church in its universal dimension is clearly in view in Matthew 16, in Matthew 18, 17, it's the church in its local character that's in view. This is the first New Testament reference, then, to the local church. It's interesting, isn't it? The two references in the gospel, one is to the universal church, one is to the local church. Interesting. Two. Second observation. It's also an authoritative body with power to exclude impenitent members. Now, this is not brand new. The Kahal of Israel could exclude members. Maybe not for impenitence, but they did exclude or keep people out. This is a body with certain membership qualifications. This characteristic of Yahweh's church is not surprising, since the assembly of Yahweh had entrance qualifications and could expel individuals from its membership. Third observation, according to verse 16, its proceedings must follow an approved legal path with two or three witnesses necessary to convict a person of wrongdoing. If he doesn't hear you, take one or two more. So in the mouth of two or three witnesses, every fact may be confirmed. Now, where's this idea of two or three witnesses come from? From the civil law of Israel. In this citation of the civil law of Israel, the suggestion is present that the church is somehow the continuation of the church of Israel, and that the judicial laws that governed Israel are in some way legitimately applied to the church. Here's an interesting thing. The old Reformed extreme doctrine, not old, but 20th century, of theonomy or Christian Reconstruction, kind of insist that you've got to take the civil laws of Israel and try to get them voted in as the laws of our country. It's a notion that's interesting, but a lot of people were attracted by it, of a political bent of mine who were Christians. But here's the thing. When you actually look at the New Testament, you say, how does the New Testament use the civil law of Israel? It uses it in two ways. It applies it, it uses it in the context of the church, and it applies it to the church. And it uses it in the context of eschatology, and applies it to the second coming of Christ. But there's not a single instance of the civil law of Israel being applied to the state in the New Testament. It's applied ecclesiastically, and it's applied eschatologically, but it's not applied to the state. Isn't that interesting? Kind of a telling point, I think, against theonomy. Anyhow, the identity of the church as the new Israel is further confirmed by this. When the person is put out of the church, what is he to be to you? A Gentile. A Gentile and a tax collector. He was regarded not only as a tax collector, that is to say a Jew who collaborated with the Roman occupiers, but he was regarded as a Gentile. And this again points to the fact, suggests the fact that the church is the true Israel, and when a person is put out of the church, they are no longer part of the true Israel, they are Gentiles. Okay? Fourth observation, according to verse 18, this assembly has a heavenly power like that granted to Peter. What you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven. The keys of the kingdom then have an application not just to the universal church and to the apostles, but in some sense they have an application to the local church and its discipline. It is the keys that empower the church to exclude unworthy members. It's because the church is given the keys of the kingdom that in the name of Christ they have the power to exclude unworthy members from its assembly. Fifthly, this possession of the keys by the local church, together with the fact that both Matthew 16:18 and 18:17 speak of the church, suggests that we must not separate the universal and the local church. Yes, we can distinguish them. But we must not separate them. We must not rigidly hold them apart because they're closely related. Both, for instance, have, in some sense, the keys of the kingdom. Both are the church, and to both belong the keys of the kingdom. So this inclines us to speak not of two different churches, but of the universal church and its local expressions. Sixthly, this intimate connection between the church universal and its local manifestation is suggested by the promise of Christ to be present with even the smallest conceivable church in verse 20, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst. I think this is hyperbole on Jesus' part to make a point. He's saying, what's the smallest conceivable assembly? Two or three people. Got less than that, you don't have an assembly, right? But he's saying, even the smallest conceivable assembly carries the promise of my special presence. The church is the assembly gathered by and around Christ, and thus, of course, he must be in its midst. If he's not, then it cannot be Christ's church, either universally or locally. Now, concluding summary then, the uses of ecclesia in the New Testament all fall into one of three categories. Okay? It's used twice of the Old Testament church, three times of a civil church, an assembly of a city, and it's used of Christ's church 109 times in various ways. The 109 occurrences in which reference is made to Christ's church can be distinguished into a number of subcategories. Sometimes it's difficult to be sure which category the occurrence should fall into, and that may be because the context doesn't provide sufficient information, and sometimes it's because there's a little bit of a slippery quality, and I think an intentionally slippery quality between the different usages of it. The universal church slips into the local church. The church as an institution slips into the church as a meeting, okay? And so we have to be aware of that. The two great subcategories are the universal and the local church. I count 19 references to the universal church. And regarding that, we have to say that there are a number of these that are difficult to categorize because at one point in time, there was a local church that was also the universal church. You realize that? The church at Jerusalem, when it was the only church, was both a local church and a universal church at the same time, right? So sometimes it's difficult to know how to categorize some of the references, the early references to the church at Jerusalem. Second, I count an additional four references as what I call transitional uses. In these texts, Paul seems to be describing a local church, but then he seems to describe it as an expression of the universal church, and so it's difficult to should we put it in the category of local church, or should we put it in the category of universal church, or is it somehow in transition? And that's what I think is actually happening. The local church is being described in terms of its being an expression of the universal church. So the 83 remaining references are to the local church. And here again, some of them are references to a literal assembly or meeting, and others are references to the church as an institution. Again, there's a slippery quality. So you can see this in Matthew 18:17, in fact. When Jesus says, tell it to the church, what's he talking about? He's talking about a literal meeting, right? And yet, when the church puts the man out, he says, let them be to you as a Gentile and tax collector. Then it's starting to sound like the church is an institution, organization, right? And really it's both, and the one usage kind of slips into the other. I count at least five usages of ecclesia as references to an actual meeting. The other 78 uses I categorize as referring to the local church as an institution. So here you go. Here's the outline. That's what I've been saying. All in handy-dandy outline form for you, okay? Related terms. Body, Ephesians 1. Bride-wife, Ephesians 5:23-33 and Revelation 19:7. Temple, two words that are relevant to temple, house and temple, oikos and naos, 1 Peter 2, 1 Corinthians 3. And there are a lot of other parallel terms like flock, people, race, nation, synagogue, priest, priesthood. All of these have relevance to the church, but are not as important as body, bride, and temple. Okay? And now, here's my comprehensive summary. Kind of hard to read, I know. I've made it as large as I could for the slide. And Charlotte's back there staring at it and saying, wow, I can't, that's really small print. I need to get my prescription checked. but here, let me tell you what you're looking at. This is my attempt after studying the whole issue of all the usages of church in the Bible to try to synthesize something and put it all together in some sort of chart form that took account of the differences and the similarities of the different things the Bible does. Actually, I was teaching this in China when one afternoon in my room, I began to chart this out for myself and realized maybe I understand this better now. So what do you got here? Well, there are three phases: eternity past, this age, and the age to come. See that? And in eternity past, there are references we call it to the ideal or invisible church. Here, the electing Christ in the mind of God before creation are the church. One can call this the invisible church because the elect are not fully visible until the consummation, but the description invisible is problematic. Then you actually come into history, this age, and you have the institutional or visible church. The church manifested in history as an earthly organized institution only imperfectly and gradually approximating the church purposed in the mind of God. So you have the institutional or visible church, really no references to it, kind of precursors in the family of Abraham and the children of Seth, but you don't really have an organized church until you get to the Church of Israel and Mount Sinai. The Exodus, Redemption, and Sinai create the typical or preparatory church, the Church of Israel. But that is fulfilled then with true redemption from sin in Christ, which creates the true or realized church, what the New Testament calls the Church of Christ or the Church of the Messiah. And all of that is heading towards the consummate or eschatological church in the age to come. And this consummate or eschatological church in the age to come is where what was purposed in the mind of God is now created at the end of all things, so that what was in the mind of God, the invisible church, has been created and is now the visible church at the end of history and in the eternal state in the age to come. So that's what I'm saying, and you can think about that and see if it's helpful to you. I'm just trying to bring everything together in a kind of synthesis there. All right, thank you for your patience. That concludes the first lecture. So, questions, anyone? Man, I always am astounded at how clear I must be that no one has a single question. Maybe it's an opposite problem. Maybe it was so unclear that nobody could figure it out, but I hope not. Scott Oft-Autry asks, off the top of your head, do you have any other references regarding theonomy and civil law? No, like I said, I'm not aware of any application of the civil law of Israel to the state in the New Testament. As to how it applies to the New Testament church, sure, okay. In 1 Corinthians 9, Scott, there's a reference to civil law about the ox that treads out the grain, and it's applied to the support of pastors. So that's another one. Sure, if I thought for a moment. There are other references to two or three witnesses in the New Testament as well, Scott. I'm thinking of maybe the end of 2 Corinthians at chapter 13 as well. Oh, yes. Eric is saying that you have the two or three witnesses with regard to bringing a charge against an elder in 1 Timothy 5:19 and 20. John Ferguson asks, does our conclusion about the church being the true Israel impact the interpretation of Romans chapter 9 through 11, especially 11:26? Well, John, you go right to the heart of it, don't you? Well, it certainly does impact how we interpret Romans 9 to 11. However, I'm gonna say this. I don't think one's interpretation of the meaning of "and all Israel will be saved" is really determinative of an eschatological position, because I know amillennialist, postmillennialist, premillennialist, and dispensationalist that take all Israel as ethnic and a reference to ethnic Israel, and I guess on the other hand, the position that would be peculiarly amillennial and covenant theology would be that I don't know that anybody but amills or postmills would say that all Israel is the sum total of the elect. And I have to be honest with you, I've been on both sides of that debate. I used to think that all Israel was all ethnic Israelites that were going to be saved, not necessarily in a mass conversion at the end of the age. But now, old Palmer Robertson changed his position, and when he changed his position, he changed my mind too. And so he says that all Israel is both all ethnic Israelites that are saved, as well as the Gentiles that are grafted into the one olive tree, Romans 11:16-24. And he says that therefore the all Israel is a reference to the one olive tree with both Gentile and Jewish branches. And that makes a lot of sense. And I think it carries me, although I understand the argument. For a long, many years, I was carried by the argument that in the context, Israel is ethnic in Romans 11, and therefore when it says, "and all Israel will be saved," you have to take that as of ethnic Israelites. But I'm not so sure now, because I think the phrase "all Israel" may have a different connotation than simply Israel. But like I said, I don't think it's determinative of one's eschatological position. Any other questions? Okay, let's take a break. We'll come back at 20 till and start our second lecture.